everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on March the 9th, 2016. Moi Rot here alongside Rolo T, and we're going to be talking about some manga today.
Manga, Nick!
Manga. But
I do manga, feel manga. I would be remiss not to mention, Nick, that I have been binge-watching, of course, everyone's favorite new series, Fuller House, on Netflix. The Full House...
Favorite in sequel. Apostrophe marks.
You know what? I didn't ever consider myself a fan of the original. I knew of it, and I know I watched episodes of it, but didn't consider myself a fan. For some reason, though, Fuller House, very watchable. Okay. The first episode's a little rough, because it's a lot of...
setup.
Well, it's not just a lot of setup. It's also a lot of shitty jokes. Like, a lot of, I guess, the jokes they have
wait,
to kind of get out.
Fuller House spinoff has shitty jokes.
I mean, they have shitty jokes in every episode. It just feels like pound for pound, there's more of them in the first episode, particularly because they have to get a few things out of the way. Like, oh, Kimmy Gibbler's living at the house. Like, can't believe, oh, you're living here? You know, like, get those out. Like, why isn't Mary, or fucking, Michelle here? Why isn't Michelle here? Like, well, Michelle's busy running her media empire up in New York, or a fashion empire, and they'll look towards the camera begrudgingly.
Well, the Olsen said no.
Yeah. They might say yes, because it already got a second season. It was out like a week. But otherwise, it's actually a very watchable show. I don't know. It's one of those things that, like, I could be doing something else, have it on in the background, occasionally look up and be like, that's kind of funny, that's kind of cute. Plus, the middle daughter from the show, Stephanie, is now an adult, and she is absurdly hot. Like, unfairly hot at this point in life. So, that played into it. But, from watching it, I can confirm that it does capture all of the spirit of the original Full House, and that no person of color will ever watch it. They're like, this is such... White people have such lame problems!
Now, let's be fair. Taj Mowry played the littlest kid's best friend for a couple of seasons, so I'm sure that he got his family to watch it.
Maybe, yeah. Because they did try to at least add some ethnicity to it, in that Kimmy Gibbler's daughter is half Hispanic, but there's still no black people on the show. I'm trying to go back, and I'm like, is there even, like, a small notable character who's black in the show at any one point in time? And none are coming to mind. No, there's an episode with a couple Indian characters. And that's it. Yeah, no, it's pretty white all the way through.
Second season's gonna start with, like, that maid who was in a few Tom and Jerry cartoons. As a new character. It was like, oh no, please go back to having no black people.
Can't you pay some, Mrs. DJ? Like, thanks. Thanks, Lasonda. Just like, I'm not really sure about this. It seems like a curious decision.
Just like the exact same. You never see her face or head or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. It's just her from, like, the pro... They essentially just get Leslie Jones from the Ghostbusters trailer and intersect her into scenes there. Like, the devil's lap! Like, thanks, Lasonda. Catch you tomorrow. It's a Cadillac!
Who would have thought that the one thing people had the biggest problem regarding that entire reboot was not a matter of sex, but race.
It's like, well, it's like, yeah, we put, like, all women in. It, like, the three of white people can still all be scientists, and let's ghetto this roll up a little bit more while we're at it.
It's like they wrote... It's like when they were writing it, and they originally had a male cast still in mind. They were like, and this one will go to Chris Tucker. And then when they decided to have an all-female cast, nah, don't change any of the jokes. Nah. It was... Oh, God. There's a problem.
It's astonishing.
I'm not one of those people who says, like, oh, ruining the original, but I look at that and I'm like, wow. Like, the only ones I can point to and go, yeah, that's definitely a joke. We're given to her. And all of them were like, cringy. So.
Yeah, well, her entire role, you're just like, this is a bit weird. I understand where you're going with it. Like, if you're trying to be a reboot of the original, you're like, all right, three regular Ghostbusters who are scientists and one normal person.
And then, the black guy.
Yeah, and you could even say, like, it's a little bit weird that you do the black person again as the normal person, but it's not as though Winston's role in the first movies were necessarily degrading. Like, he wasn't a stereotype. He was just a normal dude. Instead, right. Some would say he's the most admirable of the bunch because he's the only non-freak in the group. He's like, I'm just here for a paycheck. All the other three are like sociopaths or complete weirdos.
Oh, I'm just this and what? I forget what Bill Menery's character's name is. He's just there because he wants to bang, you know, to bang the girl, you know. Bang Scorny Weaver, which is a pursuit that many, many men could relate to in the 80s. And
yeah.
Arguably today, too.
But
that's also a kind of a... It makes him more sleazy than the others, whereas, yeah, Winston is just, you know, there, and he realizes what he's gotten himself into, and he decides to stick with it. So, yeah.
But then this Leslie Jones character comes in, and, like, in the span of a minute, she talks about Cadillacs and Jeebus. I'm not even 100% certain, because I think her line's like, the devil's alive, and in hearing it, I'm not 100% certain she doesn't say devil, like, with a B in the middle, like, the devil's alive!
And it's not like Winston went around, because, you know, they do that whole breakdown of their character roles in the trailer, and, yeah, Leslie Jones is just like, you guys are scientists, I know the streets. Winston never at any point was just like, you guys are all nerds, but luckily you got me with all my street spots around.
At least even that phrase would be better. Her exact wording's like, I ain't so good with all this science stuff. Like, science stuff? What kind of phrase is that?
All your smart white people talk.
All these things you need a degree for.
Oh, God.
I'm just like, can we talk about this? I think it's great we have all female characters in the main role, but I think we need to take another look at this.
I have a degree in linguistics, particularly ebonics. Jesus Christ, stop, please.
I'm minored in sass. Like, alright, I don't...
Like, even if I thought this movie was going to be great, I can't go see it now because you make me feel guilty.
Oh, God.
Anyway, we're going to talk about manga this week.
We're going to try.
And we're going to not do any offensive black stereotype voices anymore. Thank you. So, yeah. Next week we're going to be talking about Ajin, which is, I swear, we're going to be talking about that manga next week, and I'm never going to be used to how you're supposed to pronounce it. I think I've said it wrong just now. I think it's like supposed to be Ajin, which just sounds weird.
This is an off-topic thing. But I need to bring it up because it's now on my mind, and otherwise I'll never remember it.
Okay.
How do you know the term for a genie? D-J-I-N-N? How do you pronounce
Jin.
That?
Jin.
Jin?
That's all right.
Because I
don't know if that's right.
It's a word I've seen a billion times from playing a lot of fantasy games, and I've never heard it said. Like, generally when I hear it, people are like, genie. So I don't know how to pronounce it, and it's one of those words, and I'm like, one day I'm going to try to say it. I'm going to be like, Dijin? And people are going to be like, what the fuck?
I think that's actually close.
See, I don't know. I'm like, is it pronounced phonetically? Is it like the D silent?
It's Jin.
Jin? Alright. There you go. Apparently I said it back in Magi. Well, there you go. I probably embarrassed myself then.
Or Maggie, apparently, because it's an anglicized it. But no, I'm going to say Magi. No, fuck you guys. No.
It probably should be Magi. Magi. Like, Gift of the Magi. I don't know.
Recap portion of the week, the mag recap time. Speaking of magical beings, let's start with our mage knights one. Last time, it looked like Asta and Yami were in a bit of a bind. They three head followers of Leashed had all shown up, backed them into the corner, but fortunately, three new magic knight captains showed up in order to save the day. Including...
It was a tense 30 seconds where it seemed like all hope was lost.
It looked like they were going to die for about 4 pages. It was a very fairy tale kind of moment, honestly. Oh no, they're all boned up. They're going to be fine. Good thing I built up... good thing I didn't leave on a cliffhanger. Would have been terrible. So we are introduced to these captains... And in two cases, actually reintroduced by Finral, who apparently has collected all of their trading cards or some shit. He points out that the new one that we haven't seen before is Jack the Ripper, captain of the Green Praying Mantises, whose magic is severing magic. As Finral fangasms, He's a super sadistic destruction fiend who brags that he'll slice up the whole world. Supposedly, he shaved a whole mountain away in a little dust up with Yami. Mr. Pokedex.
What would the old Pokedex sound like? Was it like Charmander, the flame-tailed Pokemon, like Captain Jack the Ripper, Captain of the Green Praying Mantises?
That is better than I can possibly do a Dexter voice. So yeah, let's keep with that. Yeah, Charlotte Roselay of the Blue Rose Knights. Remember, she of the all-female group.
Yes, who hates men? They hate men, Nick. We don't know why, but they hate men. That's literally their defining character trait.
Except she doesn't hate Yami because she has a crush on him.
Oh, Nick. Love blooms on the battlefield.
I am... Every time that this character does something, I like her less. And I already didn't like her very much. Like, she doesn't like men. Except for the one guy that she does like. And he makes her heart go doki doki. And it's like... I get it. She's a tsundere. I get it.
She's a super tsundere. She's like a tsundere to the ninth degree. Nth degree, sorry. Ninth degree is very finite.
Also, oh gosh, I can't remember getting his name. Nah. Silva. Nozel Silva. That was it. Nozel. Yeah. He is there too with his stupid braid, which fortunately Yami spends like 3 panels just talking about. Like, how does he get this hair like that? And Ness is like, well, he probably has servants do it like that. What? No, that's lame! Why would he have people help him with that stupid haircut?
I just think it's really impractical. Like, the more I see it, I'm like, it would just get in your way all the time. Like, it's always going to be constantly blocking your vision in some manner. Like, it's not even like one over the eye or something like that where, like, it looks cool. Like, it's just it's like a rat tail that just, like, went down the front of his hair instead.
Your depth perception is going to be constantly adjusting with that kind of haircut.
Yeah. Maybe it's like a magical item.
I do like how Finral gives all of them these big introductory speeches. Like, it's the royal captain of the decorated silver eagles, Nozel Silva! And he gets done introducing all 3 of them. Gosh, just like, who are those guys? And Finral says, what? You should know who they are. They're captains. And he's like, well, they're not Marie, so I don't care.
I really love the notion that Gaush is, like, that dense that he doesn't know 3 of these people. It's not he's supposedly not an idiot. He's just, I guess, really naive or really ignorant, because it's like, these are all pretty huge people. Like, you had to have seen at least 1 or 2 of them at the selection ceremony or whatever. Although, I guess maybe he was brought upon unconventionally.
Because Yami found him and said...
Yeah, and he was formerly in prison, so maybe that's why.
Yeah. But I do like that he's just like, oh, they're not Marie, so I don't care who they are.
Yeah.
Asta gets really excited and wants to join the battle once more, and Nozel's word bubble knocks him on his ass. It's a very bizarrely comedic panel where he's just like, stay out of it, pond scum. And the word bubble... just smashes into Asta's face and he falls over. It's a little bit of a weird moment, but I guess it's like, this is the end of the comedy now, but we're going to close with a very weird comedic joke. As Nozel remembers the entire crux of this series, which is Royals shitting on Asta for not having magic powers. We went like a dozen chapters without this coming up, Chris. It had to come up again. It had to.
Yeah. Specifically this exact phrasing, though, of, like, you have no magic. Because it wasn't even the case of, like, Asta can't do this. Because we got that not that long ago. In fact, we had it twice not that long ago. But this one, it was like, but the main theme of the story is Asta has no magic. But the true magic is believing in yourself. Or friendship or something. I don't know. He did it.
And this is really weird because Nozel was, you know, present when... Asta helped to drive off all those forces and stuff, but apparently, yeah, Nozel's like, nope, I got teleported away, didn't see you do any cool shit, so fuck you.
People are saying you're not doing the voice. Did you have a voice for one of these people?
Did I have a Nozel voice? I think I might have, but I don't remember it.
I don't remember the Nozel voice, yeah.
Do the voice. Where's the voice? Broken. You'll have to remind me what voice I did for any of these guys if you want me to do it. Oh, for people. Oh, right. Who should not ask? Stay on the bus. Go with the captain. The bigger bed. I think that's how I win. It's been like 40 chapters since I actually pressed that out. Yeah. Anyway, so the three captains pair off with Leash's three followers and start clashing against one another. And I will say, I do like a couple of things that we get to see them do. Jack basically just uses his slicing magic to do that whole, I cut a huge crater, not crater, canyon in the earth thing. The salamander woman goes up against Nozelle, and it seems like she had the type advantage at first, because his mercury immediately is melted away by her flames, but he just says, like, yeah, well, your flames are not going to overcome me. Who do you think I've spent years competing with? And the image of Fuego Leona, you know, rises up behind him, which is like, oh, that's a cool moment. But the fight we don't really get to see too much more of, because immediately we cut over to Yami, who is like, hey, Fenrir, can you use your teleportation magic again? And he's like, yes, let's get out of here! And Yami's like, nah. So they plan an attack, and Leashed is still in the recovery flames that the salamander user cooked up. And he's like, they cannot win against the third eye, because we are beloved by mana, blah, 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 blah. Also, we want that special grimoire that the boy has, and we'll take it back. Yami then appears above him, swinging his sword down to attack him, but Leashed has figured that this would happen, and he has a counter ready. He's about to throw some light magic at Yami, but then Asta appears from Leashed's blind spot, and everyone's like, how did he get over there? And Leashed realizes, oh, nobody saw him because there was a smoke barrier, and
they couldn't detect
magic,
him.
Yeah. So no one could actually detect him with our special magic sense. And Asta says, my magic is never giving up. While Yami is like, I believed in our no magic idiot. And Asta swings his cleaver and seemingly kills the fuck out of Leashed. He is bending around that sword. It does not look good for him. He has at least a broken arm.
Yeah, well, I think we've reached the point now where Asta's sword seemingly only cuts magic. So right. If it hits somebody, it's, I guess, essentially just a blunt instrument at that point.
Right.
Otherwise, he'd be just chopped in half.
Right. Okay, so...
Let it out, Nick. Take your time.
Alright. I'm going to make a wrestling analogy now. One of the reasons why 10 to 6 months ago or so, the people were upset with WWE was because the heel world champion Seth Rollins looked like an absolute bitch despite retaining his title all the time. He was never allowed to look competent in any respect. Eventually, they finally seemed to find his groove when he was actually, like, you know, looking more intimidating and stuff. But for a while, it was just like, he would literally just get away with it, and it was like, well, who cares that then, you know? He's not actually, you know, doing anything for us. He just has, like, all these people helping him out. The premise being, okay, well, that makes you want to see him lose even more because he is such an absolute bitch, and everyone should be able to beat him, but he keeps on getting away. But it was never, like, on his own back. It was because he was just this guy that had about 20 different people helping him out. That's Leashed right now. He's got these three super powerful guys that are presumably going to be, like, more important now, and if he is going to actually go forward as our main villain, which... I'm not certain of anymore, because even though he had that big introduction and he is seemingly being built up as the leader of this group, It's just that he keeps on getting his ass kicked in this fight sequence. In his first fight scene that we've actually borne witness to. And so I'm just kind of thinking, like, something has to change here. Something has to change, or else we're just going to look at Leashed and go, hey, remember that time that that Asta and Yami kept on kicking your ass over and over and over and over and over again the very first time you showed up after you had taken down approximately no one that you didn't get a sneak attack on? Yeah. He's pathetic. Like, every time that he's going to get curve stomped now, in the rest of this fight, it's just like going to be kicked. It's going to be, you know, beating a dead horse. You know, it's not going to mean anything anymore. It's like, oh, look, you hurt Leashed again. Who gives a shit? So there's got to be something different here. Like, either Leashed is going to have to get some power up, or it's going to have to be revealed. This isn't really Leashed. This isn't really the leader, or something. Because he looks like an absolute bitch. Like, I know that this is not going to end with the good guys winning the day forever. There's going to be more ahead from presumably this group. And again, I'm not certain anymore because of how easily they're besting Leashed at this point. But it's like a lot of the God, because going back to when Asta went on his first mission with the Black Bulls, everything was tied into this group. So, what the fuck? Why is this guy who's supposedly the leader getting his ass kicked so much? I don't understand it. I don't get what logic you could possibly have going forward that you're having this guy get beaten so much. Because how many times has this happened now? Like, I think this is like the third time where it seemed where he's been just completely overpowered by Asta and or Yami.
If you consider Asta getting past the defenses and knocking out the portal guy, this will be the fourth time someone's really gotten won over on Leashed in this encounter.
Yeah. It's not even to the point now where, like, they're having a back and forth and Leashed is getting in some shots and Asta and Yami and everybody else are getting in some shots. Leashed is clearly losing this fight at every turn.
The one moment that seemed like he was like, oh, okay, he's crafty. When Yami comes down, he's like, I knew you were going to come down. I had a counterattack ready. It only is there to be like, ah, but I knew you were going to have a counterattack ready, and I had a counterattack ready for that. And you're like, ooh, that's your one cool moment is already being diminished in this chapter. After reading this chapter, I had to check. Because I was convinced at the point, I was like, oh shit, Black Clover must have tanked in the ratings and is getting canceled.
That's what I did too.
They have to wrap everything up.
So I was like, no.
It's doing great. It's doing astonishing.
Pages, it's like never going below doing mediocre. It's routinely getting into the top five. It's getting regular color pages. It's doing great. So it's not rushing towards a conclusion.
I will be honest, at this point, because this is a horrendous chapter, and this is terrible from top to bottom, in my opinion. I just think the writing in this chapter in particular is really bad. And I feel that Tabata? I think it's Tabata. It's hard to tell with the letter or not. Tabata. Tabata-sensei, I think, is a better writer than this, but this chapter was not a good showcase of his talents.
It is Tarata with an R.
Tarata, okay. I didn't even actually pick up that this was supposed to be a Fenrir thing, that he was like a big magic knight nerd, because it really just comes across like someone explaining who Jack is, mm-hmm. when we've never met him before, like just giving us all of his details. I don't care for the Blue Rose captain having the, oh, I hate all men, but I secretly love Yami. It's just like, ugh, I don't know. It's kind of a unfortunate kind of situation to play with. But the ending itself really just has me confused, where to the point I'm concerned, I'm like, maybe this is it. Like, maybe this just ends here, that Leashed and these guys all lose here, and that's the conclusion of this storyline.
Right, we just have a different villain next time, and Black Clover basically becomes Jonin Jump's fairy tale.
Because I'm just looking, and I'm like, there's a couple areas it can go from here. There is still that rune that we saw the cloaked figure looking at way back at the start of the series. The one that had, like, the different... I forget what you fucking call them. It's like the orbs. If you watch Frontier, it's Mercury Mon's Beast Evolution is what it looked like. Right. Like, the eight little fucking spears connected by the little rods and shit like that. He was looking at something like that that hasn't come up again since then. And there's still technically demons that existed in this world at one point that haven't come up since then.
There are definitely a lot of different things that Black Clover could do aside from sticking with Leashed as a main villain going forward for a while. If they're going to drop him here and move on to something else, I get that, you know. But at the same time, then, if that is what's going on, what a goddamn terrible first villain.
What a long time, too, to get to him.
Well, even, I mean, it's just the first year of publication when you think
about
it. You know, having your main story, your first major arc end after 1 year, that's not too ridiculous. But if you think about it, it's like, this doesn't really mean anything if it is just going to end here, because what has this group actually accomplished? Jack shit!
Like, they crippled an old lady and a coward, an idiot, when they attacked him from behind.
Right,
and supposedly he cheap-shotted Fuego Leon, which is the only way he managed to get a victory over him, according to a lot of people.
So, I mean, is that just it? Maybe it's going to turn out that this group that Leash is a part of, it was just a subsection of, like, a larger group or something like that. But, I don't know. I can't, at this point, I literally cannot imagine that Leashed is going to actually stick around for a significant period of time. I think that it's possible that Tarazza did this whole thing in order to leave himself an out in case the rankings started to tank so that he could have a good closing up point. And now that his series is doing well, he'll instead move on to something else.
See, I'm not certain it's even that, though, because I feel like Black Clover's actually been doing very well since it came in, so he shouldn't have been fearful of the rankings. And when you think about it, it's if these guys are defeated here, it is even more weird when you consider that the magics they have are pretty significant. Like, light magic, copying magic, one of the four elemental spirits. Like, those aren't things you just have get beaten in a relatively easy encounter. Like, that just seems like a weird thing to kind of waste and throw away. But at the same time, I don't know where they can go from here, where if Leashed escapes from this, and the next time he shows up, having any sort of reasonable threat about this guy, unless he shows up in, like, a Gundam, like, powered by demons, like, or on a, like, a meteor storm, like, coming towards their little town, I can't imagine how this dude would ever be a threat, so I have to imagine this is just it for him, but I don't know anymore. I don't really know where it's going. My ultimate thought on this is, like, no matter how this ends, the saddest point of this is that for a while I was really liking Black Clover, but as of these most recent chapters, the only thing I have to look forward to in the future now is maybe finding out if Gaush is supposedly special or not. But there's nothing else really I'm looking forward to anymore.
Well, I think there are some other side characters that could come up again that we like. Like Rebecca.
Well, that's not going to be an important character, Nick. Did you see the cover page at the start of the chapter?
Got credit listing despite having not once appeared in this entire goddamn arc.
I don't know if she's not in the chat room right now, but if she is, I want Annalisa to, like, use any political power she has within the company as the letter for World Trigger to make sure Yuno always gets on the cover page introduction thing, no matter how long it's been since Yuno has been in the series. He always needs to be in that character profile blurb on the side.
Oh, God. Alright. That's our big-ass Black Clover rant for the week. Let's move on to not Bleach, because unfortunately, Kubo got sick. I have no love lost for Bleach, but it being off because Kubo fell ill is very unfortunate. So I hope that he gets well enough soon to finish his stupid fucking series. And
so backhanded. Now I hope he gets.
That's a legitimate feeling, by the way. I like anything that someone produces that is, like art or fiction or anything like that, I never want to see it end because a person got sick. Okay, that's bad.
So I guess we'll move on to Fairy Tale then. Mm-hmm. Chapter 476, Farewell, Magical Girl. The cover page is just happy. So, last time...
With, like, the least effective bow and arrow ever.
Yeah, it's like a... Like, I guess it's supposed to look like a cat print. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, that's not going to pierce anything. It's not going to do anything.
It doesn't even have claws on it.
No. And you're shooting it from so close, why don't you just jump up and grab the fucking berries if you want them?
You can fly!
Yeah, it seems very superfluous. Alright, so, last time... We found out that Di Maria had the ability to control time, and Old Tyr showed up to basically give our heroines a chance to counteract that. You know, they weren't able to, or Old Tyr herself couldn't get involved in the fight. She couldn't fight Di Maria because she's only like an echo in time or something like that. But she could offer the two a chance to defeat her. It would require them to use Third Origin, and it's, I guess, it accesses all of your potential, but in return, you'll never cast magic again. And in the entire scuffle, Sharla was attacked and is basically on death's door, frozen in time. Once time is unfrozen for any reason, she will immediately die if someone doesn't heal her. So they're at a very bad crossroads. So that's where we start off, and both Wendy and Sharla, or not Sharla, Sherry, want to become...
Sharia.
Want to become the person who gets Third Origin done to them. Because both of them are heroic, and they want to make the ultimate sacrifice. They don't care about the other one, and it's more important that you survive. No, it's more important that you survive. And they're friends, they talk about how, you know, Wendy's saying, it's my job to protect Carla, so I should be the one to do it. And, you know, Sharia's like, well, that's exactly why you can't do it, because you need to be the one to heal her afterwards. And they have kind of their back and forth and everything like that. You
know, as much as Sherry's been built up as Wendy's best friend, rival and all that stuff, every time that she comes up and just like, how did she show up in this series again? I literally have no recollection of how she even got involved in all of this. And it's just like, I kind of just like assume that at some point she just popped up in her current role and that was it.
She basically was revealed to be the, because they had that weird role in the Magic Festival arc or Magic Tournament arc where it was teams of five, but you had like an alternate member,
right?
And she was the alternate member for her guild,
right?
So she came out, and then Wendy and her had a fight against one another because it was wind powers against wind powers, and it became super besties after the fight was done.
I imagine there were lots of underage panty shots in that fight.
No, because just like you get in this chapter, anytime Wendy's in a situation that happens, there's, like, a delicately placed sound effect or something like that to cover up what would be a risque shot. Apparently, as we found out last week, they don't always do that. It's just some chapters, I guess, he goes for more than others. But I remember it being a pretty bad fight back then. Asheria is not a particularly compelling character because her... Really,
she's
her...
Like, she's like Wendy with boobs, so...
Yeah, I mean, she's, I guess, a more... outgoing version of her, but there's really not much to her character beyond I'm super besties with Wendy. Like, I really couldn't tell you much about her otherwise. But anyway, Wendy takes the lead because she pushes Sherry away and she's like, fuck, give me that goddamn Third Origin. So she takes it and she goes all out. She's flying at her and using her wind powers. And Di Maria's like, bitch, fuck off. And just, you know, slapping her away with what I guess is time slashes of some kind. I don't know what she does. There's just like...
Nor do I. I mean, I can understand, like, I am Kronos, the god of time, therefore I am immortal. I get all that. I don't know what the hell... She does this thing where... is it like she's causing Wendy's body to age where her magic touches her? Because she still doesn't look, you know, like she's aging. It just looks like she's...
I guess you say maybe she's weaponizing, like, cracks in time? I don't know. It's kind of weird. Either way, she's using...
And then she shoots a freezer finger beam.
Yeah, she's using get hurt attack, basically. And it is hurting her, and, you know, Di Maria's just like, don't you not understand the folly of a human attempting to touch a god? Because she's just no-selling everything Wendy's doing to her. Like, gets punched right in the face, and she's just like, bitch, please. And yeah, she said she freeze the laser beams her. And Wendy's just like, why isn't this working? Is my third origin not unlocked? What's happening? And it seems like she is going to be done for when Sharia interferes and knocks it away, and she has big, giant tits now. Because she, well, I
bigger,
guess...
Bigger, gianter.
Yeah, she was the one who accepted third origin instead, actually, as we find out
like,
here.
I do like how, like, there's an explanation that Sherry gives where she's like, I basically deceived you. You know, I let you go ahead thinking that you had gotten the secret technique cast on you, while actually I was hanging back so that Ultier could pass it on to me. First panel where she's explaining this, boing?
Yeah.
Like, Jesus Christ, come on.
Yeah, there's literally even the blump sound effect to show that her tits just bounced in a fucking still medium.
Like, she's like, it's like that, what was that one series we had to read? My Otome, or whatever, where the character who had vibrating breasts as her attack.
Oh, yeah, like breast
chakras.
She's
like using that to talk and give her explanation or something.
It is kind of weird, because I get, like, the sacrifice that she made. I'm still a little confused as to when it took place, because we get explained right here, like, or the explanation of Third Origin happened to these two at the same time just a moment ago, and this chapter picks up right from them.
So
then
Sharia,
those two argue.
Sharia, presumably, as Wendy dashed forward, was like, don't actually use the power, don't actually.
Yeah, like, very quickly, was like, don't actually give it to her, just pretend you're going to give it to her, but actually give it to me. Like, it just seems like there was a weird, like, pause in pause time for her to be like, alright, now she's gonna run forward. What I need you to do is give her a fake power, I don't know, like, make her hair just get really long and spiky, kind of like Super Saiyan 4, but without any of the power, and just let her go along with, I know this bitch can control time and can literally just, like, age her into dust in a heartbeat, but let's just go along with it until you give the power actually to me, and then I'm gonna, with my big giant breast, take her out. Alright, let's do this. It just seems like, I'm like, when did this conversation take place? But she does have a legitimate argument. She's like, look,
right,
she's not right. For nothing. I'm the God Slayer. If anyone's going to have a chance against this God, it's me. So she is given the third origin, and she explains that this is her farewell concert, and that she's on top of the world. And she uses all of her special... Well, here, all right, anime guy in the chat saying she talked to her when Wendy was fighting with the Dragon Force. But at that point, she had taken the power from Ultier. So unless Ultier consciously was like, oh shit, I get it. She can't actually. I'm going to give it to her instead and gave her the fake one. Then why? I mean, if she was going to do that from the beginning, why even offer them the option too? But it just seems like that conversation took place in like a weird period that shouldn't have existed.
Maybe she started casting it on Wendy. And Sherry was like, wait, you have to cast it on me. And so she stopped casting it? Maybe?
Yeah. It still feels like there wasn't really a period for that all to happen. But either way, it's a minor, you know, bitch point to have, or a nitpick to have in this chapter. Because Sherry is now super badass, and she's like, I'm fighting for my best friend. And she punches her in the face, and her God-slaying magic's able to actually work on her. And Demaria's like, holy shit, you actually have God-slaying magic. This sucks. And basically,
just joking about that.
Yeah, oh, fuck me. Sharia almost gets killed, but Wendy uses her magic to shield her from a lethal attack, and the entire time Sharia is going through her inner monologue of things, like, I've always been clumsy at everything I try, except for one thing, magic, which is weird, because it's a character trait I don't think I actually had up until this point. But she notes how magic gave her the opportunity to meet so many people.
It's sad because she's losing the one thing that she's actually talented at. She's not going to be able to do it anymore. Which, I don't know. Didn't she?
She's a pop star.
Were she and Wendy, yeah, idols a second ago?
Yeah, she's still a pop star. I mean, she's using that analogy all through this. This is my farewell show. I'm the magical girl, like, of an idol kind of thing.
You won't be able to use magic during your show anymore, but I get the impression, based on what I know about idol fans in Japan, that wasn't what they cared about anyway. It was a much creepier thing that they cared about.
Yeah. Sherry is going through a whole thing of like, I always love magic, but from now on I'll just be a normal girl again, and this is the last magic I'll ever do, but it's okay, because Being a magical means a lot to me, but I've found something that matters even more. Love. Because love is stronger than magic, Nick.
Oh my god, love. That's like uber friendship.
that's super friendship. That's how she's able to beat him. She uses Amano Murakumu? I don't know the fuck to pronounce it. There's no translation here. I assume it's like windy spiral.
Amano Murakumu.
Yeah, blasty doom dragon power slash or something like that. Wolf. Wolf dragon. They're all the keywords in there. And the unfrozen world starts, or the frozen world starts moving again. Wendy immediately casts her healing magic to save Carla, and presumably Sharia has lost all of her magic, but she says, Wendy, don't cry. A person can live without magic, because love is stronger than magic, you know? And Wendy's crying, because she's like, mm-hmm. And then we cut away to what I believe is Ultir in her old body, her old woman body, what she's become now, and she's like, those girls have true strength. If only my youth had been a little bit more like hers. If only I had a near duplicate of myself in a rival guild who could have become a fucking model and idol like I did with me. Perhaps I wouldn't have become a time terrorist.
Perhaps I wouldn't have tried to kill Grey that one time. Oh, well.
Yeah. Whoopsies.
And this is actually kind of weird because it makes me think, so is she actually aware of what her other self did to help Wendy and...
Yeah, because she's the master of time herself, so she can, I guess, right. Is aware of the fact that the echo of herself was able to interact in that world.
Weird.
It's very weird. It's a very strange chapter.
It's a very stupid chapter, and it goes alongside, like... I believe you predicted that no one was going to lose their magic. I had the feeling that if one of them was going to lose their magic, it was going to have to be Sharia, because who cares about her?
Yeah, Sharia, the moment that it was like, oh, Wendy got it, alright, well, no one's going to lose their magic. When Sharia gets it, I'm like, alright, maybe she will, but I will not be surprised. In fact, you know what, I'll make the prediction out here, Nick, because I'm great at making predictions. Like my great call about Rebecca never being an important character, I'm going to say Sharia, by the end of the series, gets her magic back. Or some manner of magic back.
Well, I'm going to predict that Di Maria is dead, never coming back, ooh. Just like Unohana.
That's a good one. That's solid. I feel like we need to...
I don't know. I think that fewer people die in Fairy Tail than in Bleach. So.
I feel like what we need to do, Nick, we need to... You ever watch Carl Stone Cold Lock of the Century of the Week?
Of the Week.
Yeah. Of the Week. We need to start doing that for manga. Every week we make up one of our, like, a Stone Cold prediction.
It's our Stone Cold Lock of the Century.
Of the week.
I can't believe that Carl has outlived Aqua Teen Hunger Force. That's so weird.
I think Aqua Teen Hunger Force is still going on in some form. I think it's just called something else now, but it's still the same show. I think it's called, like... Aqua Police Hunger Hour or something like that. They actually, I think, for a moment, tried to make it what the show sounded like it was. Like, oh, police, like a superhero squad or something like that. But yeah. No, it ended. I'm pretty sure. If it did, it ended very, very recently. But I believe it just exists in another name now. Anyways, I won't hold us up on that. That's Fairy Tale for this week.
Okay. Let's move on to Food Wars, Shukyaki no Soma, Chapter 157, Dancing Salmon, which promises a much more entertaining spectacle than we end up getting.
Okay, yeah, the cancellation just happened in 2015.
Okay.
So there you go.
It must have been brought back several times then.
Yeah. It went, Aqua TV Show, apparently, was what it was called for a bit. Or something like that.
So, anyhow, last time, Rentaro revealed what his dish was, which was a salmon au confit flamme, which was a salmon dish that he prepared using all sorts of modern technology, including a convection oven and other stuff. So he presents his dish first, and so everyone, of course, is wondering what the hell is going on, and he actually offers that Momo, the other, the Council of Ten member who was present, He's like, "Oh, why don't you taste some of this?" And she says, "Why would I want to eat your food?" And he says, "Well, I used a certain dessert as a garnish to give the dish dimension." So, yeah. So everyone tries it, the judges as well as Momo. And I was very concerned about this chapter. And my concerns were mostly justified, I shall say. As Momo digs in, she tries the main fish dish first, and she gets... Okay. Remember that, you know, that one, short where they had the Shonen Jump female leads show up, uh-huh. and the girls lost their clothes, but Chika didn't. You know, she just kind of was like, "Oh, it's so good." Momo does that first.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, all right, we're safe. We're okay. It's okay. But then Shunseki decides to go, no. She's 17 in reality.
He's like, "She only looks like she's 8. You can do this."
So she tries the sweet, which Rentaro explains is... Let's see.
Salmon ice cream.
Yes. He used the cryogenic blender to create it. And so what happens is... See, I pureed salmon with a blender, blah, 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 I made... So
I thought you were about to make Rentaro super French, like, "Oh, I pureed the salmon in the blender and throws the resulting best."
If we're going to do a goofy voice for Rentaro, it has to be something that has to do with his gimmick of heat or his stupid fucking appearance, one or the other. He's not going to be snooty French. I can't do that. If someone has a suggestion for that, because he is apparently going to have some lines, I'll do it.
Let me flip through my list of celebrity impersonations, see if anyone fits this. There's a lot to get through here. No. Oh god. I have so much here. Jerry Lewis.
No. You're the Jerry Lewis guy anyway. So.
Eric Cartman.
I'm not going to do an Eric.
Adam Sandler? Do you have a good Adam Sandler?
Never tried Adam Sandler. I don't really want to. Because there's a couple of different Adam Sandlers you can do anyway. I don't know. Hang on. No, I'm not going to try that. No.
Alright.
No, anyway. Let's not waste any more time on this. If something comes up, it'll come up. Momo reacts to the salmon ice cream, essentially. So the riptide. She is unable to avoid the riptide as salmon surge past her going upstream, and her clothes are torn away from her body by the power of the riptide, except for her panties.
Oh, you know who he could be? Because I'm trying to ignore the fact that this scene exists at all. He could be like a super Brooklyn accent, because he kind of looks like Joey Wheeler from Yu-Gi-Oh!
There could also be a bit of a Sanji thing going on there, because Sanji used the French terms and the fire and like stuff. Okay. Everyone is like, "Oh, well, he apparently is quite a talented cook," and both Aldini and Soma are like, "I can't believe you were so great. Yeah, you're really good. Hey, who said you could use my first name or familiar like?" I don't think I can do a real Brooklyn accent. I can do a Joey Wheeler impression.
that's all you need.
Hey. Everyone's like, "I can't believe it. Yeah, it's gonna be another crushing victory for Central." And Kuroki was like, "What do you think you're doing? Don't go passing down judgment till you've seen what I can bring to the table." And he lays out his salmon and produces Kulibyak. I'm glad that someone in the audience immediately pronounces it exactly like I just tried to. Kulibyak?
Is that... I tried to pronounce it in my head, and I was like, "I know how to pronounce that. I don't know how to pronounce it." I was thinking Kubiak, like the coach of the fucking, the Broncos.
Oh, God. So, everyone was like, "Oh, yes, that's why he was preparing both rice and bread." And Alice explains it's a type of pirogue, a puff pastry or brioche, shell, filled with sweet or savory stuffing. In this case, it's rice and salmon, wrapped in brioche. And long explanation over the background of this dish, but basically it is, yeah, a type of pastry.
It's like a pierogi.
Very, pretty much, yes. And so the judges chow into it, and they react, and they're like, oh, it's so delicious, the soft, flaky brioche shells. Oh, it's so yummy. I will say this. It sounds and looks tastier than Rentaro's dish. I could totally imagine chowing into one of these things, as opposed to, oh yeah, made salmon ice cream. Like,
well, here's the thing. If I were into fish at all, perhaps I'd have a different opinion. I like this one because there's at least a meat in it somewhere.
Right.
But if I were into salmon, the idea of, like, pure salmon wrapped in bacon and then, like, playing with the idea of heat does seem like a pretty interesting kind of dish. But that might be the inner hipster in me talking. Like, ooh, science food!
So, Alice gets a slice of this and it's like, oh, hey, Tadakoro, you're like, don't look underage and stuff, so why don't you try this instead of her?
And this one I love.
I fucking love this image. Because she doesn't get her clothes torn off by fish. She explains it thusly. The flaky bread crust has concentrated all the deliciousness of the ingredients into a flavor bomb. One bite and its savory goodness will explode inside my mouth. At this close range, this powerful of a blast, I can't avoid it! As a robo-salmon launches a hyper-beam at her and vaporizes her clothes off.
Just blasts her clothes off in a super-beam. It's awesome.
See, this is what I like about Shokugeki no Soma, is, yes, that was fan service, but the imagination required to think of how you ended up in that embarrassing situation is amazing.
It's so absurd, you can't help but laugh.
The, you know, the merman with the face of a seed, with the head of a seed, is molesting me. Like, it's like that. You know, it goes back to, you know, Arina's first example. It's like I'm taking a hot bath and there's a gorilla inside the bath.
Yeah. Like, you're just like, this is fan service, but it's fucking hilarious.
Someone analyzes, oh, you know, this is Kurikiba's trademark dockside brawler power used in a decadent dish meant for royalty. You wouldn't think they would work, but they come together perfectly. It seems this dish, too, is a result of all the years those two have spent competing with each other. Which I like. I like that, you know, they say their show, this is the influence that Alice has had on Kurikiba. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, he is defending something for the two of them, so it makes sense that he would do something along those lines. So one of the judges speaks up and says, I can't actually decide.
It's a tie. Yeah.
He says, it's a tie. There's no way. I can't label one as inferior to the other. Both chefs have presented dishes that I can only call the pinnacle of salmon cooking. But the older judge, the one that whose name I keep forgetting, but who is, you know, given more background, he says, no. Tasting them side by side makes it obvious. There is one clear and decisive difference between these two dishes. So, this was quite an up-and-down chapter for me. I do like the conclusion here because, you know, looking at it either way, it's like, it's not just one beat the other. It's, they were incredibly close to each other, you know? Mm-hmm. So, to make another wrestling analogy, if you have two competitors have a hard-fought contest, then regardless of who wins, both can look good coming out of it. And they had to have these two present very different dishes, have people react very similarly to them in terms of these are both amazing and it's really hard to decide between them, is better than, well, Kurikiba just beat the new guy, or the new guy just beat Kurikiba. So,
yeah, if Rentaro loses here and he shows up again in another cooking contest, you're not going to be like, this clown, this leashed over here.
Right, this is a guy who took Kurikiba to the limit, or Kurikiba still looks good because he took this guy to the limit. So.
Mm-hmm. Who do you think wins?
I get the impression it's going to be Kurikiba, but I won't be shocked either way.
I for a moment, I thought it might be Rentaro, because I thought his dish was the more pure salmon-based one. But at the same time, it seems weird if they're like, clearly these dishes are both the pinnacle of salmon dishes. I'm like, well, that's Curakiba's whole thing, is seafood. So it makes sense if he has the better dish in what is essentially his specialty.
And that's another thing. If Curakiba loses here, then it's going to show, oh, you know, these guys are no joke in terms of, you know, we can take you on your specialties and beat you. So.
Yeah, it could go either way, and I guess that's what's pretty exciting about it. I would feel really bad for Curakiba if he lost, though.
I think that that's probably going... That, and one other thing. So the one thing is, I think Curakiba kind of has to win because it's his specialty. And the other is, I feel like Rintaro was... I honestly think that the ice cream thing is a cheap trick, honestly. You know, it's like, oh, you know, I just added this as a side dish, to, you know, in order to add more balance to it. Curakiba had one thing, and he put everything into that one element of it. Whereas Rintaro's just like, oh, you know, I have this fish thing, and then I have this ice cream over here. Fuck off, you smitty French fancy presentation asshole. That's what I hate about cooking shows. The one biggest pet peeve I have seen 11 seasons of Hell's Kitchen, and I still get pissed off whenever someone puts down this giant square dish with a little bit of food on it and a whole bunch of sauce sprayed everywhere. So anyone who presents that kind of dish in this, I'm immediately going to be like, fuck you, I hope you lose.
Just bitter and angry at them.
Yeah. Anyhow, that's Food Wars for this week. Looking forward to the conclusion of this. And
yes.
I'm looking forward to what comes after. Let's see. My Hero Academia.
Yes.
Chapter 81. I forget what the chapter title is this time. Hang on a second. Let's see if I can find it. Roaring Upheaval. So, last time, the mysterious top hat guy with mask seemingly magicked both Tokoyami and Bakugo into little pellets in order to kidnap them away from the Bakugo Protection Group. They only just noticed Tokoyami's missing, too. Good job, guys.
Tight. Whoops.
Sorry, Tokoyami. Sorry, Bird Boy. And so, I like that this guy's way of doing things was just like, I'm not going to stick around fighting, guys. I'm just going to leave.
He's bye! Like, I suck at fighting. My whole thing is taking people.
Deception and running away are actually my only specialties. I can't go toe-to-toe with heroes in training. And not only does he immediately run away, he... also makes sure to contact his allies. He immediately gets on a headset radio and says, the target's been captured, so let's go. Our mission's done. Let's get out of here. And I like that we cut to all the different members of the squad, regardless of their condition. So, you know, Moonfish, the guy that Deku took out, they're, you know, both slumped over unconscious. The school uniform kid in the gas mask is unconscious. A character we haven't actually really seen before is getting the message, but you know, Dosu's getting in and all that stuff. It's Dosu, right? I forgot his name.
Which one? The guy with the scars?
Yeah,
that's Dobby.
Dobby. Dosu is a Naruto character.
Might be.
Dobby.
Like the house elf, Dobby.
Very well. So yeah, they're trying to stop him, but it, I mean, Todoroki is really the only one who has powers that can actually keep up with the guy, and he can't really catch him. So they're like, oh no, what are we gonna do? Cloning guy is like, now that we've actually caught on to what his gimmick is, I'm liking him more. Because he's like, oh wow, yeah, Mr. Compress sure got the job done quickly. He took his sweet time, come on! it makes the chapter end on a line that I absolutely love. But anyway. Dobby expresses concern because he's like, well, there was supposed to be a whole bunch of flame and gas concealing this meeting spot, but it seems to have all cleared up, so we can't actually go with the original plan. We get a little bit with Aoyama, who is hiding behind a bush next to the unconscious bodies of two of the girls. I forget their names. It's the Earphone Jack girl and Invisible Girl, who is finally wearing proper clothing for once.
Is she?
She's got a shirt.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see it now.
But he's like, oh, what am I going to do? You know. It looks like Dobby briefly catches him But cloning guy brings his attention back, and he's like, don't we have to, you know, call Nomu? They said that he only rests your voice, so that seems kind of important that we actually do that. We cut to said Nomu, who is rather terrifying. He has chainsaw arms, so...
Many of them.
Multiple chainsaw arms. Well, he also has a drill arm, and a hammer arm, and chain arms. Yeah. So, also, is that a missile arm? Or did he break something? What is that thing he's holding? I can't even...
In the one panel, it looks like he is... I don't actually know what that is.
It looks like it's... It's clearly broken.
Yeah, it looks like part of a manacle, maybe?
Nah, I don't know. Yayorozu is being carried by Awase, who I guess is from Class B, because I definitely don't recognize him.
Nah, yeah, he's one of the other kids.
And
Ragdoll's headset is what people are saying.
Oh. Well, that's no good. Well, Awase does observe that he might have killed one of them already. So, yeah. Gotta give him props because he's actually carrying Yayorozu alongside him while this is going on.
Yeah, he's outright dragging her at this point.
Yeah. So, props to you for not leaving her behind. But, anyhow, it stops and gets called away just in the nick of time as, presumably, Dobby calls it back as a cloning guy. Suggest that they do. But Yayorozu, despite the fact that she, you know, is bleeding heavily from the head and is wobbly and thus had to be, you know, moved away, she takes action. She says, oh, you know, quick, you know, you use this, you know, your quirk on this and put it on him. And presumably she puts some sort of, I guess, tracking device on the monster.
Yeah, that's what I'd assume it is.
The Nomu. And we're introduced to Awase's quirk, which is welding. And so he can basically just stick things together at the atomic level. So, we cut over to where Tiger and... God, what was her name? The other one. Not Mandala. Something along those lines.
You get it. It's close enough.
It seems like they've just, you know, taken down the two that they were fighting with. Introduced to Tiger's ability, which is Playa Body. He's soft! So, in contrast with his work out your body and get big muscles and stuff, he's kind of Mr. Fantastic kind of thing, which I was rather surprised by. They've got their two villains held down, and it looks like they're actually going to... it looks briefly like they're actually going to just capture them, but the lizard guy that's being held down... decides to use his quirk, seemingly, as he...
I don't know if it's him or someone else. It seems like someone else.
I think it's actually the Voidhead guy that hangs out all the time with Demora.
It would make sense. Isn't his ability teleporting or creating portals, yeah. So...
And Shadow is creeping up around them. So, yeah, it's not the lizard guy who says this. I thought it was the first time I read it, but yeah. Deku and company are still chasing after Top Hat guy. And then he's like, wait, I've got an idea. Uraka, make us throat. And Asui, throw us with your tongue. And they're like,
And then Soji, you can correct our course in midair. And then Uraka, you drop the gravity and we'll plummet down towards him.
Deku, you've got two broken arms. I have to do it!
Do it!
But so they're just like, okay. I don't really know exactly what she does. Uraraka tells Deku to use this, and she takes her outer shirt off and throws it at them.
I think she's using it to basically splint his arms. Because you see it later on, you see bandages wrapped around his arms with sticks in them to basically keep his arms from becoming more mangled messes than they already are.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what she was going for.
I do really like the panel where they're flying through the air because, you know, they've been made really light so that they can be thrown far and have just been thrown through the air. And Shoji and Todoroki very much looked like, this was a bad idea, why did I agree to this? And Deku's like, I'm gonna save Gotcha.
My crippled ass will save them.
I just love the expression on Shoji's face, because you can only see his eyes because of, you know, his weird body, but yeah! And he's got, you know, all his different eyes grown out through his body, and they're all wide in terror. Then we get to the villain meetup, and it's for the time being just Dobby and Toga and Clone Guy. And Toga is being a weirdo, although Dobby specifically asks her how much blood she got. She's like, "Oh, you know, just one." And Clone Guy is like, "You're supposed to get at least three." And meanwhile, Toga's like, "I made a friend. Also, there's a boy I'm into." This girl's creepy. Just at that moment, Dobby looks over, and I don't know exactly what he's looking at, because they're not next to the Top Hat guy. So maybe he sees them fly through the... Oh, yeah, they... Okay, Top Hat guy arrives.
Top Hat guy's coming, yeah.
You're right, he's about to see them, and presumably he sees Deku and company flying through the air before he sees Top Hat guy, as Deku and Shoji and Todoroki crash down on top of him and pin him to the ground. And it is a pretty cool-looking single image, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, all three of them immediately like, no, fuck you, pinning them down to the ground. And then they look up, and of course the villains are still there. And I fucking love the line that this ends on, with the clone guy looking at them and going, I know those brats! Who are they? it was a weird chapter this time. I have no idea what the hell is going to happen from all this. It seems like Deku is going to be scraped up from the ground and, like, deposited in a trash can to be taken to heal later at this point.
Yeah, well, this was the location they're all supposed to meet up at. And as we know now, they're the only ones coming, because everyone else has either been knocked out, or it's essentially those two characters who we think that the teleporting guy has already come to get.
Well, the Nomu might be coming.
Yeah, the Nomu is another one. And I presume since they put a tracker on it that they're going to be escaping. So I feel like these characters here... Because the chapter doesn't end. It ends with them knocking him down, but you don't see like the orbs falling out of his hands or breaking or anything like that. Presumably he still has Bakugo and Todoroki, or Tokuyami rather. So it's kind of interesting to see what happens there. But these are, from what we've seen, the three most... built-up members of the villain group, Vanguard group. At least two of them are. You know, twice is less of a significant figure, but the other two are the big ones we know of. So, and only one of these guys is really in any condition to fight, and that's Todoroki. I mean, Shoji, I guess, presumably can still fight, but he doesn't really have a combat-specific quirk to really use here. So it is kind of interesting to see where things go there. I would have liked this chapter a bit more if we had had more things to follow along with in between this and Deku's fight. Because this is a really big moment, particularly for Deku, of how much he's putting his body on the line to save Bakugo. But it's not all that far removed from the last time he put all of his body on the line to save somebody else. I think this is still an awesome moment. It's super cool seeing it happen. I just wish there had been a few more chapters, maybe focused on some of the other fights, to give me a bit more of a break between these two moments happening, because it's hard for this moment to feel big when something huge along these same lines happened not that long ago. It's still awesome, though.
I liked it.
It's a good one.
I do want to briefly talk about Nisekoi, because it's a Raku Light storyline that we've got going on, and you gotta appreciate those where you can find them. So, but this picks up where the last one left off, with Ruri and Shu getting the little foreign girl trying to find her parents, and Ruri is talking to her and in English throughout the chapter. But Shu is actually proving incredibly useful during their search. Like, he's getting his information network to help give them ideas on where her parents could be. He's noticing the things about the girl and using that to find ways to comfort her as she gets upset. She's got this little pin of this one dog character, so I got this, you know, stuffed dog thing, and I saw her checking out these treats in the window, so I figured she would want some, and stuff like that. And Marie's just thinking to herself, I didn't think this was that he was this kind of guy. I've always had him pegged as this creepy idiot. In addition to Marie very stubbornly trying not to come to terms with her obvious feelings for him, we get this explanation for why Shu is acting the way that he is, which is that he actually really looks up to and admires Raku for the way that he acts, because Raku is always, you know, giving his all in order to help people around him, and that combined with advice that he got from their teacher Kyoko made him decide that he should, you know, try and give more of himself to help people, and so he's going to do that, and yeah, oh, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I actually almost made Shu my character of the week because of what we get from him in this chapter. It went to someone else.
Don't spoil it now, Nick. We're still too early on in the episode.
But yeah, that's all I wanted to do was make note of that. I really like these two characters, and I'm glad to see more, you know, a couple of chapters focusing on them. I am absolutely certain that either next week or the week after that, it'll be done, because that's how Nisuko has been going through its side character wrap-up stories recently. But, let's do One Piece, which, Jesus Christ, what didn't happen in this chapter of One Piece? Holy crap, bombshell after bombshell. Chapter 818, Inside the Whale, Decks of the World, opening page is about Dragon's crew focusing things, which is a little bit of a surprise considering how recent characters they are. But.
Well, remember, it's everybody in the world reacting to the Straw Hat's bounty, and mm-hmm. the revolutionaries are essentially Robin's only family at this point. Mm-hmm. So this is, I think, the thing. Because last week was, or the last time they did it was Frankie and the Water 7 people reacting. So I think this is going to be them.
They had Laboon for Brooke.
Yeah, so I think this is showing basically Robin, and kind of in a way, quasi-Luffy.
And then Vivi for everybody.
Yeah.
So,
what I really wish we had seen, though, is just a shot of fucking Jesus Burgess, like, in the background, like, tiptoeing towards them, like, like with a frying pan or something, like
cartoonishly large that he stole from Usopp.
Yeah, like still, or like a cartoonishly small one for his giant hands.
Oh god. I like how Usopp and Luffy and Chopper are just, like, hanging off of Raizo. They're just going, oh, and he's like, stop it. You only saw my ninjutsu through coincidence. I didn't really want to see. But then, pretty shortly afterwards, things get really emotional because from their spots on top of the whale tree, he and Kaido and Kinemon all look down on the Zo country and how it's been ruined, and they're like, oh, it wasn't like this, you know, when I first came here. The city and rivers were pristine. And you know, Raizo is like, I'm so sorry. I will work to make this right, because they feel so guilty that they lost so much protecting him. It's like, yeah, it's... This element that's been, you know, like, introduced only a couple of chapters ago, it's... I really like seeing this, you know, sense of caring between the two groups. Mm-hmm. It builds the both of them up more. Cat Viper calls them all back inside the whale because the reading of the stone is complete. Robin, yeah, has translated the poneglyph, and now he's like, yeah, you know, I can use this to actually, you know, draw us up a course, give us the naval map. So Cat Viper explains, yes, this is why the whale forest is held sacred and why the guardians are necessary to protect it. The red stone is called a road poneglyph. It is meant to serve as a guide to the place the most powerful men on the sea seek, the end point of the Grand Line. And Yeah, so basically, as Doggy Pine puts it, you know, there are four different ones that can be found, and they all point to a different location in the world, and the point where the four intersect, if you draw lines between them, that is the location of Raftul, the final island, which for centuries has only been reached by the King of the Pirates and his crew, which, of course, were One Pieces. So, yeah, this is kind of a big deal, isn't it?
This is the plot of the series. This has been the big thing, the thing that's been kind of teased for a while, and this is a chapter that's just like, all right, we're going to explain shit to you now.
This is, like, yeah, they're actually, like, going to try and track down the stuff so that they can go where they've been trying to go for fucking 20 years, almost. Or I think over 20 years at this point, hasn't it? Because didn't it start in... No, it started in 97. Okay, so. As Catfiber puts it, here's the thing. There is only one of the four Opongas that we don't know where it is, because, you know, this one is here, and the other two are in possession of pirates already. The Emperors of the Sea, Big Mom, and Kaido, King of the Beasts. Again! What the fuck? That is a big deal!
Yeah, they've both taken them, and at first to kind of be like, huh, I wonder why that is, though I heard some explanations on it, people theorizing that Kaido and Big Mom maybe aren't interested in One Piece. They're like, I got a good thing going already. But they want to make sure other people don't get to it. So by keeping one always in their collection or in under their guard, they can assure that no one will be able to find Raftul, essentially. And this does explain part of the reason, like, you know, why if Whitebeard was so strong, was he never able to find One Piece? Or why did he never reach Raftul? Like, was he just dicking around? It's kind of interesting to be like, well, he actually couldn't because other people were preventing him from doing so, and for the emperors to go to war would have been a huge deal.
Right. I like the Straw Hat's reactions to this because, you know, it kind of like cut this neat, you know, line on the panel where for people finding out because Brooke and Nami and Usopp are going, ah! And Luffy is like, all right, that's good to know. And Frank is like, yeah, we just got to steal them. And everyone, you know, the freaking out people are still freaking out, and Luffy's like, I was just gonna whoop their asses anyway, so who cares?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Catfiber says, actually, you don't need to steal a poneglyph. You could, you know, actually just print out the message. I mean, no one would really want to just lug these huge things around, and it would be very inconvenient in order to actually find where you're trying to go. And Usopp's like, so we just need to sneak in and make a quick copy before any of them realize it and slip off to Raftul. Then you'll be the Pirate King. And Luffy's like,
no, that's bullshit. It's not honorable.
Catfire points out, you know, I'm actually really worried for Robin's sake because, you know, anyone who would be interested in the void centuries out there collecting prints of the Poneglyphs, but none of them would be able to decipher the meaning. So when the time comes when they want to know the truth, big players from all over the world will be after you. And Robin's like, yeah, I've got powerful friends to protect.
This is a sweet little moment.
This also changes the way that everyone's reacting, because Luffy gets all embarrassed, and Chopper does this whole thing, and even Usopp's getting fired up, and Nami says one of my favorite lines this week, if they do, you know, mess with you, I'll take their life and their money.
Just an intense expression. It's weird. You don't normally see Nami being the one who's, like, fighting, yes!
So Robin asks the obvious question, which is, how do you know so much about all these poneglyphs? And Catfiper starts to tell a story, but then he says, well, do you mind if I actually tell them about this, dog? And instead of answering, Doggy Pine glances over at Momonosuke, who says, you know, there's no need to hide secrets from them. You can tell them everything. To which Luffy responds by poking him really hard in the cheek. Because Luffy is just an asshole sometimes. So Catfiper explains, for generations the Kozuki clan of Wano has been a line of stonemasons cutting and carving stone. Even now, their skill with rock is unparalleled. 8 centuries in the past, the Kozuki clan created indestructible stone documents the poneglyphs.
Another pretty huge revelation. We didn't know who made them before, and it's like, boom, the Kaizo family did, or Kazuki.
Bombshell number three. So, I love Luffy's reaction to this, where he's like, wait, these stones that Robin's been searching for, you? And my sister's like, I didn't do it. My ancestors did it, you fucking idiot. And Luffy asks, okay, so do you know what's written on them? But Kanjuro clarifies, no, they didn't pass down that information. And Kinemon says, yeah, you have to read the stones to learn the contents. But they also explain, before Lord Momonosuke could receive the teachings in order to read the ancient runes, the process was cut short in his father Kozuki Oden's generation. And they're unable to actually say what happened, because Kinemon starts to say it. He's like, yes, Lord Oden, Wano is... And they can't stop. He and Momonosuke start to tear up, and we get this flashback to, presumably, his final words, which were, I am Oden! I was born to boil! So, presumably he was cooked to death, it sounds like. But yeah, they say, yes, he was put to death by the Shogun of Wano and the pirate Kaido. Which is explained, of course, why a member of Kaido's fleet is messed around on Zo, presumably. So yeah, they explain that Oden gave his life to save the lives of all of his servants, and Kaido, Emperor of the Sea, and his Animal Kingdom pirates are in Wano. So presumably, yeah, we're gonna go to Wano at some point, as you actually predicted, but I don't think you would have predicted for these reasons.
Well, this is the interesting thing, is we're at a really weird and intriguing crossroad, where on the surface you're like, next stop Wano. But I'm not sure if they are, because they've got Big Mom and Big Mom still out there. She also has a poneglyph, and that's where Sanji is. And so it's a case of, like, which one do you go for?
And also there is that location of the poneglyph that they've currently got.
Well, that one seems like it's... I'm not entirely certain. It seems like it's worthless without the other four. Because it seems to just be a point on the map. It doesn't necessarily apply to a location.
It does.
Or a physical location.
It does right now, but I wouldn't be surprised if for some reason they still have to go there for some reason.
They might. And then they still have to figure out where the last one is. So it's interesting to see, like, what are they going to do going forward? Because they really have two directions to go in.
Right.
And both of them are going to lead into a fight, presumably, with one of the emperors.
So Zoro asks the obvious question, but he's like, I mean, you don't have to answer this, you don't want to, but why was your boss executed? Does this have to do with you guys being captured and chased around and so on? And Kinemon says, yes. His crime was grievous. Kaido is attempting to pry information out of us. The old daimyo, Lord Kozuki Oden, rode with the king of the pirates, Goldie Roger, to Raftel, the final island, and it was there that he learned the secret of the world. What a goddamn chapter.
It's a lot. It's a lot to take in, a lot to think about, a lot to process, a lot said within this chapter that now puts new context to the things we learned about before.
To spoil some stuff at the end of the episode, the poll going on in the chat room right now, 67% of the chat room chose One Piece as their favorite chapter of the week. And I'm like, yeah.
And see, I can actually see the numbers through my hitbox. It does nothing to stress how absolutely dominating One Piece is in this poll. It's absurd how many votes One Piece has compared to everything else.
Like about 30 minutes before we started the show, I was trying to figure out, what am I going to do with my chapter of the week? Let me review everything. Oh yeah, One Piece. Gotta be One Piece.
It is awesome. It's a great chapter. I mentioned before, I love it when we find out more about One Piece, the world. And this isn't like teases. This isn't like, oh, and here's another player. This is like saying, like, all right, here are the details. Here's what the poneglyphs are. Here's who made them. Here's how you find Raftel. Here's the person who made it. And here's a person who rolled with Gold Rogers. Like, this there's things in this that are now explained because of this. Like,
here's why Kinemon is here.
Yeah. Way back in Skypiea, they found a Pulmonograph there, which is interesting because it implies that the Kazuki clan traveled to all these islands across the world dropping these things off. They left one on Skypiea, and that was the one, that was where we first found out Gold Roger's real name was Gold D. Roger, because it actually, he carved a message into it. And presumably he was able to do that because of Odin being part of his crew.
Right.
Presumably, a master stonemason.
Which indicates that someone's probably been to Skypiea. I mean, well, presumably he was like, so, Odin, where's another one of these poneglyphs? Oh, I left one up in the sky. Okay, let's go.
That's the only thing that I'm kind of curious to find out the reason for. It's basically the how Odin got to Gold Roger, because we know he's from the East. Well, actually, no, we don't know he's from the East Blue. Or is he? Yeah, he was, because he was born in Loketown. So he's from the East Blue, presumably started there. And I'm just wondering, when did Odin get there from the New World, like, travel over there? That's always one of those things I'm like, I'm waiting for the answer on that. But regardless, it's like, holy shit, that's a lot of pretty huge things. And to be fair, I think at that point, it might not have been in the sky, because that was the part of Skypiea that was still on the ground before it got knocked up by the knock upstream. But it's just a lot of interesting things that are kind of coming to light because of this. And we don't know that much about Gold Roger's crew. We know about Gold Roger, we know about Silver's Rave, and we know that Shanks and Buggy were both, like, ship hands on it. But this is another person that now we know about. Oh, and Crocus. So we know a couple members of that group, but now it's like, oh, hey, we're finding out more about this thing. Let's get some more explanation. It's really just interesting.
So, yeah, I am very intrigued by this. So, yeah. Anyway, Toriko. Gourmet 361, The Lurking Demons. So, Toriko and everybody decide to partake in Another, and News, and Earth, and Adam. And, it's a rather gross chapter.
It's grosser. This chapter is far grosser and disturbing and horrific than anything with Neo had been.
Right. Neo didn't cause people's tongues to grow out all weird, okay? There is something that is very important that happens in this, as Starjune ends up eating some stuff, and he's like, oh, you know, the effect of another, and he's like, I can't remember my food memories either, but he eats, you know, a bite of the meal, and he gets this flash of himself in the womb with another baby that has scars where Toriko has scars. And he looks over at Toriko, and he just has this look of shock on his face. I think it's actually a very effective little moment, because he doesn't say anything.
No. Yeah, it's kind of a cool thing to be like, hey, you know, these two are brothers. We didn't say it really before, but now, yeah.
Twins. Although it is weird that he has, like, those scars, that they both have scars in the womb. Because, I mean, like, all right, Toriko's, I can sort of get. Maybe he scratched himself while he was in the womb or something like that. Starjun has, like, burn scars. How the fuck did that happen?
Well, it could just be, like, birthmarks. I might sound like I might reveal myself to be a super idiot, but isn't that, like, what Gorochov has? Like, the splotches on the head? Like, it's a skin condition more than it is actually, like, burns?
Maybe it's also a weird gourmet cell thing, too.
Yeah.
Zebra threatens to lick Komatsu to death.
Ew. Yeah, that was a weird moment.
He's just, like, licking the top of Komatsu's head. It's weird. But basically, the people with, you know, Toriko and Zebra and Coco and Sunny, because they have eaten this stuff, their demons are reacting through their tongues. So Coco's got this nasty tongue that's, like, you know, dripping poison. Sunny's just got a bunch of hair flapping out of his mouth. Which, how is he talking? Gigi explains that, oh, you know, your demon's reacting to another and so on. And he explains, oh, you know, These are the stories of your demons. Your Sonny, your demon is the hair monster that devoured not only living planets, but also entire planets. It was a demon that spit out the inferior rule ones and ruled the very Milky Way. It's like, we get it. Okay. They've got demons inside them. That's cool. He doesn't really say anything particularly important. Although he does kind of mention, oh, another thing, Toriko, you have more than one demon inside you. Toriko's like, I think someone told me that before. Anyway, this stuff is delicious. They finish eating. Komatsu's like, wait, it's too early to mark the end of the meal. Do you remember this? He produces a tin can. It's something that Octo happened to find in the Golden Marsh in Area 8. And they found tin cans. And he's like, oh, what do you think is inside? And Toriko sniffs it. He's like, it's going in my full course after I've sniffed it. Oh, good, because I have gotten someone who created a can opener for me. Thanks, Melk. And so they start to open it. And Gigi's like, oh, inside of that thing is... And that chapter ends there. It's a weird goddamn chapter. It really is.
Get a lot of,
character revelation. Weird tongues. Demons that we already knew most of this shit about. And I'm going to put this in my full course menu. Whatever the fuck is inside this can that we need a golden can opener to open.
Well, there's only two things left for him to put spots in, right? I think it's his meat dish and his fish. I think he has everything else. I mean, his main's empty, but he said that God's going to go in there.
Right, right. Toriko, full course.
Because he has an appetizer, he has a soup, he has a drink.
He was filling them in, like, this way.
He has a salad. He has a dessert.
He's got BB corn, he had the
Billionberg egg, he had century soup, he had
the rainbow
fruit, the salad, I forget what it was, like air, not air, but it was like a salad in the sky.
So presumably it's going to be the fish.
Yeah.
He's got, his hors d'oeuvre, his appetizer / hors d'oeuvre is BB corn popcorn, his soup is century soup, the main course is God, the salad is air, the dessert is rainbow fruit pudding, the drink is the Billionberg egg. And that leaves fish and meat, and presumably it's going to be fish.
A can of sardines.
A regular can of sardines. Look, you can tell that no dolphins have been killed to make this.
Yeah, because there's no label, so what I don't know doesn't hurt me.
Okay. That's it.
That's it.
What a weird fucking chapter. So we're going to World Trigger. Chapter 134. I don't remember the chapter title, but I guarantee you it's Galapola Part 13, I think?
Yotaro Part 2. You seem like quite the fool now, Nick.
Oh, Yotaro Rindo Part 2. Yes, last time Husei stumbled across Reginomaru. That's the capybara.
He's everybody, Nick. He's a part of all of us. He's a little of you. He's a little of me.
There's a little bit of Reginomaru side of us all.
Every one of us is a little bit of a farting capybara. If you cut right down to it.
Oh God. So yeah, Husei immediately introduces himself and he says, "Yes, I am under the command of House Beltiston. So you should assist." I demand you assist me in returning home. Take me to your wish.
Is he as pompous as that? Like, I am Husei of House Arryn from Elf-Kator.
No, he can't be Pegasus.
let me see. Can I put on a not fae British accent?
Try being a little bit regal, but not too regal.
On size of a tangerine. I am Husei of House Arryn from Elf-Kator, under the command of House Beltiston. Hey!
You want to do a Game of Thrones thing?
Oh, yeah, like, do-do-do-do-do-do, then I guess it's like, I'm like a unicorn, I don't know, whatever their sigil would be. like a unicorn with a magnet hanging off the horn. Oh, that'd be so cool if Davos showed up in World Trigger.
Why am I you say of Alsarin of Tukator, the command of House First? I can read now.
First of my kind, Queen of the Andals. The unburnt, the unscorched, the mother of slaves.
No, wait, that's another character. Hang
on. Ah, shit. I need my other titles.
I'm just that awesome guy who cut his fingers off. Lost my little girl, taught me how to read. Why'd they burn her? That's fucking cool.
God damn you, Stannis! You were supposed to be the Madness!
This doesn't happen in the books!
No!
Anyhow, Reggie is very concerned about this, because he remembers something that not the captain's son told him. If we come across a captive from Afta Krator in this base, the order is we don't need to rescue them. Dispose of them if they interfere. So he's like, oh, it's an escaped captive. But yes, Yotaro arrives in order to stop Husei. And, well, actually, that's what it looks like at first. And of course, Husei's like, you. And meanwhile, Reggie's just like, I'm eating child. We cut to the fight between, between Gatlin and the members of the border. They've just been cut in half, and Gatlin's immediately like, fuck it, lands on his claws with just his torso, fires the cannon, which I do appreciate. It blows him backwards as he does this because he can't properly plant himself. But that one final blast is still deflected, so the mission seemingly has failed, although as Gatlin is about to suddenly break down, he says excellent to himself. So, what's going on there? Then he bails out, which...
I think he's giving him credit.
Maybe.
Because they note that, like, this mission was a total failure. Like, a complete defeat. And I'm realizing now that I misconstrued Jin's warning from weeks ago when he meant cut down. He literally just meant you'll lose your tryout body, which it seems I guess it was meant to imply there's someone strong enough to beat you in combat, which is a threat in and of itself, but I guess in my mind I'm like, huh, it's kind of weird that the threat's like, you'll lose your disposable try-on body, but I suppose in the sense, though, that their mission is just to protect the away ship, or what they were going to find out, that's still a big deal.
It could have been really bad if it were just the four of them and Tachikawa had lost before they were able to take down their enemies.
Yeah.
Especially when you consider that Kazama was, you know,
one arm from the beginning. And...
Right. And so was, what's his face with the Regis? Murakami? Murakami.
Ko-Murakami, and yeah.
Because, yeah, Konami is like the only one who's still at full strength after this battle's over. And they were outnumbering him 2-1. So. Mm-hmm. But yeah, all the members of Gallipolo start to bail out that have been disabled, including the ones that were thought to have captured by Nasu and Miwa squads. And so the people in border are like, what, neighbors can bail out now? And Kinuno is just like, that's not too surprising. We imitate technology from the other side too, so we shouldn't be too surprised when they do the same. So yeah, they're like, okay, that makes sense why they were using their strategy that way. They knew that they could be reckless because they could just bail out, same as we could. So, yeah. Tachikawa celebrates with company. Konami gives him a bit of shit because, like, you got cut down just like Jin said that you would. I used the foresight against them! You could say we even overcame Jin's foresight. Whatever.
Shut up. God damn it, Tachikawa.
This is why Konami doesn't like you. Yeah, so the barrier in front of the away team ship has taken a few hits, but it's safe, and it seems like their mission is successful. But the danger is not completely past yet, as we cut out to where Yotaro and Husei and Reggie are. And, you know, Husei is a little bit surprised that he's there, but he's like, how did this kid come to stop me? But Yotaro reaches into a little pouch, and he pulls out Husei's black trigger. And Husei recognizes it immediately, and Yotaro has a flashback to having a little conversation with Jin. And so he was like, you know, would you be happy if he joined, you know, Osamu's squad? And he's like, oh, that'd be best. That'd be great. You know, I taught Husei to do so many things. Yeah, I'll bet you did. But then Jin asked him, well, what if he said he wanted to go home? Because there's a 50-50 chance of him staying or leaving, which is why I haven't talked with Osamu about the details yet. So what do you think? Metro thinks for a second, and he says, well, if he wants to go back, I want to let him go. And Jin says, okay, in that case, I'm going to leave this with you. And he gives the black trigger. So gave Yotaro basically the choice, and true to his word, Yotaro is giving Kyusei his black trigger back.
I don't think it's a black trigger. I think it's a regular trigger. It just looks black.
Right, because his
horns have to be black, I think.
Gives him his Lambiris, his red trigger. You're right, yes. I just assumed because it was black and weird-looking. But that's racist, sorry.
That's insensitive, Nick. Yes, granted, this trigger would have never appeared on an episode of Fuller House, but...
I gotta remember, Kyusei has the white wings.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have the black trigger.
He has white power, Nick.
Metro explains that he got the trigger from Jin, and he told me that to give it back to you if you left, so if you're going to leave, you should have just told me. And Yusei apologizes and takes the trigger back, but at that moment, Reggie gets communication that they're retreating. He's like, yeah, the vice captain and Wen and Captain and Rada have failed. We've got to get out of here. So he's really upset. He's like, we were defeated that badly by Meiden, and now we're retreating empty-handed. We can't let this go just like that. And come to think of it, the whole reason we're going through this mess is all because of Aftokrator. So he has to be a bit of a dick and kind of take it out on Yusei.
Sakumi, Reggie's kind of an asshole. The one dude who's like, I'm gonna go into the city and fuck everything up, is like, oh, I'm actually an asshole.
And I get the impression that this is probably gonna go about as well as that seemingly on the surface good plan that he had. Because he says, I can't let you board the ship. There were many things about this mission that didn't make sense to me, and it looks like you're on good terms with the Meiden people. Didn't you sell out your country and join their side? And he's just like, what the fuck you say, boy? Do I need to choke a bitch? And Reggie looks up and he sees the security camera, and he's like, ah, Meiden's watching. Alright, if you want me to trust you, you must prove that you didn't surrender to Meiden. Capture that kid. Take him as your hostage. Kyusei is shocked to hear this, and Jin is spying on them now from a distance away, but he has tracked them down. So, I was quite pleased with some of the events in this chapter. I'm a little bit disappointed that, Border just fucking won.
I'm not shocked by that. It seems kind of weird, like... Almost like it was filler of like, hey, we have this other stuff going on, but we need an invasion. And it is something that did kind of break up the, not monotony, but the tedium, I guess, that you eventually get of rank war, rank war, rank war, rank war. Because we've been doing, 4 months now with none of the main cast involved?
Mm-hmm. And to see the way that this is led is what really does hook my interest in this, because it suddenly makes, the last chapter was like, oh, this will affect... Kyusei really heavily here because Yotaro's here and he's, tracked down these guys, he wants to bring him home. And, either way that this turns out, what they do is he decides to stay, which I think he will, or he doesn't, that, is going to be a big deal for Kyusei's character, and it's all suddenly, puts in perspective, this whole thing really was just an excuse to have something big happen with Kyusei. And I do want to see where that goes because, I've been interested in what's going to be done with him for over a year now, because it's been over a year since the end of the invasion arc, and he's been around that entire time.
It'll be interesting to see what happens, because I can see it going a couple different ways. Like, the most obvious solution seems to be, he'll say, go fuck yourself and not do anything, but I wouldn't be shocked if he makes some action towards it, because they point out the fact that the cameras are watching. And it could just be Reggie thinks he's going to be the super smart guy, but I wouldn't be shocked if it's like a defeat within a victory. That Yusei does something here that to everyone else looks shitty, and maybe this is what prevents him from joining Tamakoma 2 or something like that. And I've heard some people even theorize maybe Yusei just says fuck it and decides to join with him, tries to capture him. Maybe Jin comes in and rescues him and something happens there, and then Jin's like, alright, I guess I kind of have to join now. I kind of fucked things up for you really there. I really thought Yusei would be the golden one. I think it's very interesting. There's a lot of different ways I think this can go, and I'm kind of just curious to see where it is. I didn't enjoy the end of the chapter as much as the rest. I liked kind of seeing the end of the Gatlin stuff, but I could still see that this is necessary. I'm just not all on board on the Husei train yet, quite yet.
Well, that's the thing. It's like I'm intrigued to see what happens with him. Then I can be excited about what happens with him. So that's it for Weekly Manga Recap.
It's going to do it.
Yeah, so let's wrap this thing up. My series of the week is One Piece, as I said before.
What? Impossible.
No real contest there, I'm afraid. It was just really, really, really good. My weekly MVP is actually Yotaro, because I was a bit surprised by what he ended up doing, but, I mean, it stays in, you know, line with the development of the relationship between himself and Husei, and I thought that, I mean, he's been when he first showed up, he was such an annoying little shit. So I am quite pleased to see that he's...
You've come accustomed to a face now.
He is basically, instead now, more of like a... You know, he's kind of like the heart of of Tamakoma now. You know, he's this innocent character that believes in the best of people. And sometimes that makes him annoying, because he is, like, overly optimistic and he, you know, tantrums whenever things don't go his way. But to see him treat Husei this way and Husei being actually, for once, appreciative of it, I was like, oh, that's really cool. So.
I can completely see that. My chapter of week's One Piece. Really not much of a contest.
No!
My character MVP, can no one be an option?
Can't think of anyone?
I can give you somebody. It's not really... My option, if I have to, like, gun to my head, pick someone, would be Soji from My Hero Academia. If only for the fact that he looks really cool, and it's like, oh, cool, My Hero Academia rotates another side character into the spotlight and makes him look kind of cool and interesting and badass. But that's, like, I had to pick somebody. I really didn't find anybody in this week's Jump particularly memorable or strong overall, unfortunately. This was not a great week for Jump for me. One Piece was a great chapter.
The stuff that was good was more on stuff that was happening, more on stuff that the character was doing.
Yeah, no one character, I think, really stood out for me this week, I guess I should say.
Right, you know, World Trigger had developments, One Piece had developments, but, you know, it was not built around one character.
Yeah, Food Wars didn't have one character really at any kind of focal point.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually really hoping...
Neither did My Hero Academia, really.
Yeah, I was really hoping... Fairy Tail would come in this week, and I'd be like, finally, I can give something to Fairy Tail, which I don't think I've done yet. But then this chapter came, I was like, this sucks. This is so lame.
The character of the week is Carla, who was the one character with speaking lines who did not come out looking bad.
Yeah.
Oh, God. So, yeah. And, of course, the audience chose One Piece in a fucking landslide. So, yeah.
I feel like this might be the biggest... Yes. Runaway we've seen.
I don't think that anyone has gotten any week's chapter has gotten over 50% in the past in the weekly poll, let alone 2/3 of the vote. So
it's, again, I'm looking at the number. One Piece outscores its next closest competition basically 5-1.
God. So yeah, not surprising. That's gonna do it. Thank you everyone for joining us for Weekly Manga Recap, which we record here on hitbox.tv/RoloT Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, although sometimes we do need to change things up, so stay updated by following us on Twitter. He is at RoloT and I am at YRulerOfTime. And the official WMR podcast account is also out there. Be sure to check out past episodes of Weekly Manga Recap at podbean.com and subscribe to us on iTunes. Plus, leave a rating, leave a like, leave a comment.
They're doing it, Nick! There's two new ones. I've actually missed these because I haven't checked it the last few weeks, unfortunately. So, to Gigas XLR, who says, if you're looking for a manga podcast that'll help you stay on top of the current running manga while being funny, then this is your podcast. Chris's enthusiasm acts as a nice contrast to Nick's calmer and drier wit, and both play off each other very well.
Because I never get excited over manga on this show.
Well, no, you're like the... I'm like the Ricky Gervais to your Stephen Merchant, essentially. Like, you're like, I'm... You know, you're the smart one, and I'm the one... Who's loud? People are like, I hate Rolo T. He's so annoying. And also from Aerosol Hero. I'm going to read his whole thing here, if only because this story, if it's true, which it probably isn't, is very amusing to me. Do you work part-time at a private Christian school? Then you probably shouldn't listen to this while working here. It might be considered blasphemy or something. However, if you aren't restrained by that very specific situation and you love manga, then you should definitely listen to this podcast. It is without a doubt the funniest podcast currently out there, and a combination of the host's wonderful chemistry and insight makes for a fantastic two-hour experience as well worth the price of being chastised by the school's pastor because I didn't realize my headphones weren't plugged in. As a former Catholic school student, I hope that did happen, sir.
Oh, boy.
I'm raising hell fucking indirectly now in Catholic school again.
Spreading that sin via manga podcast.
Boom.
Hail Satan!
Sister Diane would be so proud of me.
Our email address is weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. You can use that to send us criticism, ask us questions for a future Q&A podcast episode. You can also suggest future manga for us to read, such as Ajin, which we'll finally be getting to hopefully next week. Stuff's come up. Shut up. We're working on it.
It'll be coming up very soon.
Special thanks go out to Steve Mann, our title artist. You can check out his work on rockfanboy.deviantart.com, idropboobs@tumblr.com, patreon.com/stevemann. Special thanks as well go out to Felix Stark for visual editions of our show, as well as Infamous Planet for all the support that he gives us, helping out on little things like, I don't know, making things that we have no idea what to do. How do you make an image background like this? What's Photoshop? I don't understand. I bet he didn't even use Photoshop. He's like, oh, he's something doing. Of course, as well, special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters, because your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. We recently did a commentary on the first several episodes of Digimon.
Yes.
Get for free on our Patreon.
Yes, it'll be up probably later this afternoon, or this evening rather, right before the episode itself goes up. And you'll catch it up there. You don't have to be a Patreon, or patron rather, to get it. It's going to be free for everybody, but it'll be hosted up on the Patreon. So you'll just go to patreon.com/weeklymangarecap, and you'll be able to find it there.
And we helpfully tell you when each episode starts.
Yeah.
Chris informed me that apparently there are some shows that don't do that for some
reason. The Frasier podcast to listen to, where they commentate over the episodes, they don't tell you when they started an episode, and they'll just be like, we started an episode, like, a minute ago, like, what are you doing? I don't, if I'm trying to watch along with this, how would I? Although some people just like to listen to it. So that'll be, that was essentially our movie commentary for February that we're catching up on. We'll still have another movie commentator. Either there'll be more Digimon episodes, or we'll do another movie, just depending on what people want of that.
Feel free to make some suggestions on that, by the way.
Yeah, if you like the Digimon commentary specifically, and you're like, do more of that, we can do more of that. So, if you have that. Also, I just want to give a quick thank you to Kurt Duncan, who is our most recent Patreon supporter. Thank you very much, good sir. Your support is much appreciated.
And, that said, that is going to do it for us. So let's wrap up this show and, I don't know, do something that can lead into Chris hitting stop recording on his end.
Well, Nick, you know what? I'm sure you heard that Pokemon's gained a new generation, Generation 7, with Pokemon Sun and Moon.
Yeah.
So I always thought when they made Pokemon Black and White, I was like, this is as suggestive as the names are going to get. Because Black and White generally refers to color, but I know I got white version and parade around white power a lot, which was a bad idea on my part. But I think these games are going to be even better, because if you take them as it is, the new generation of Pokemon, if you abbreviate, is Pokemon S&M, which I'm super excited about. So I can't wait for kids to go to Google, type Pokemon S&M, and see what the fuck comes up. So their childhoods could be as ruined as mine were.
Shouldn't they have done maybe day and night?
Day and night, sunrise, sunset, what are you going to do? Sometimes you just run into an image of Pikachu with a butt plug up its ass, and then maybe you don't. Who knows? What are you going to do? You're going to have to see it at some point, kids. But now while you still have some innocent left to burn.
Oh, I'm sure that most of them would have discovered that kind of stuff when they turned 10 anyway.
Oh, is that the time when things are supposed to happen?
I think that I first stumbled across that side of fandom when I was 11 or 10 or 11, so.
Wow. I guess it's the Catholic school. I grew up a lot more innocent. I didn't even realize there was pornography of Misty until I was like 16. I was like, there's a part of the internet where people have turned images of our beloved cartoon characters and are having them do felonious sexual acts. Indecent acts, even. I'm like, Mr. Misley! Mr. Misley! President Principal Carmel!
Oh my goodness. They're having sex and not for the purpose of procreation. Oh my.
Don't they realize that's a sin?
They're going to burn in the seventh layer of hell.
Oh, well, don't they? Oh, I've always just depended upon the kindness of strangers.
Turning more and more southern as you're...
I'm just the southern, like, I just whipped out a fan. I'm like, oh, ma.